part 4 of 9 from set number 3014, The Great Magicians, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled The Literary Magicians of the Golden Dawn.
And as announced, we are dealing with two noted literary figures who had as their principal inspiration, let's say, for their artistic work, the teachings and the practices of the Order of the Golden Dawn. Now, I will just say a couple of words to begin with to put this in context, but certainly not much, and that is that the two people whom we are discussing this evening, namely William Butler Yeats and Dion Fortune, stand really as important historical proof of the fact that the, the alternative mystical and magical tradition can and does act as a powerful stimulus to creativity. And we will have some of the statements and quotations from Yeats and others regarding that. And this is an important thing to remember because the key really both, let's say, to ceremonial magic, which was the principal focus really of the work of the old Order of the Golden Dawn, and various artistic endeavors have as their common denominator the imagination of the human being. Now, nowadays, imagination doesn't have a very good press, perhaps, and when little children tell you about, I don't know, an imaginary playmate or a ghost whom they saw, you say, well, you just have too much of an imagination, and things of that sort. But if we look back in history, we find that imaginatio, the imagination, was indeed connected with magic. Even the very word shows a connection because they all have to do with that Indo-Aryan root word M-A-G, mag, from where we get magic, we get magnitude, we get magnification, we even get magnet. And all of these have to do with greatness. And of course, in a mystico-magical sense, the greatness has to do with the expansion, with the enlargement of consciousness of the individual by occult or mystico-magical means. And so we need to keep in mind that the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which existed only for a relatively short period from the 1890s to about 1920 as a functioning body, although revival movements and things of that sort came later on too, had in its ranks really an uncommonly large number of people from the theater, and from the various other arts, and poets, and playwrights, and a great many actors. And all of that, of course, indicating that, let's say, what we in a secular sense refer to as the arts, and what in the ancient sense is called the art magic, the great art, definitely have a relationship with each other. And so we picked two of the perhaps the most outstanding known representatives of this particular convergence in the persons of William Butler Yeats and Dion Fortune. So Yeats, William Butler Yeats, of whose life we will get little vignettes as we go along, knew fully and consciously that his poetic creativity, and he was generally recognized really as the greatest poet of the English language in his lifetime, even as Robert Graves was a little bit later on. Yeats is very well known for that. So Yeats knew fully and consciously that his poetic creativity was intimately related to the forms of creativity which are usually classified as magical, or hermetic, occult, theosophical, Gnostic, and by other names, but which are really all modifications of the, let's say, the universal alternative mystical tradition of Gnosis, which some of the scholars, particularly our late Dutch friend Professor Gilles Quispel, had called the pan-Sophic tradition. Pan-Sophic meaning universal wisdom. Now here is a statement in Yeats's own words regarding his orientation toward this tradition. This is a quotation. "I had not taken up these subjects willfully, nor through love of strangeness, nor love of excitement, nor because I found myself in some experimental circle, but because unaccountable things happened in my childhood, and because of an ungovernable craving. When supernatural events begin, a man first doubts his own testimony. But when they repeat themselves again and again, he doubts all human testimony. At least he knows his own bias and may perhaps allow for it, but how trust historian and psychologists that have for some 300 years ignored in writing the history of the world or of the human mind so momentous a part of human experience? What else had they ignored and distorted?" So he finishes with a rather severe critique of, oh well, what one would call the conventional wisdom of academia. So such are the words of Yeats himself regarding the occult, the magical, the Gnostic, which he viewed as a form of creativity, a way to be in touch with the magical cosmos that underlies the apparent cosmos of outer things and events, and a way of tuning into powers and potencies that are superior to the puny forces of everyday consciousness, or to what the philosopher Husserl called the triviality of everydayness. Yeats was, of course, a kind of a living embarrassment to much of the intellectual and literary world, especially to his younger contemporaries, such as, for instance, Auden, who voiced the attitude of the alienated, flippant, spiritually impoverished intelligentsia of the early 20th century when he wrote about Yeats as follows. "How on earth, we wonder," wrote Auden, "could a man of Yeats' gift take such nonsense seriously? Mediums, spells, the mysterious Orient, how embarrassing." Now, as against this condemnation proceeding from the fearfulness and the spiritual shallowness of many of his contemporaries, Yeats asserted with quite a stern force and without any equivocation as follows: "The mystical life is the center of all that I do and all that I think and all that I write." Couldn't be much clearer than that. For a long time, the judgment of the literati was that, considering the weird nonsense that Yeats was involved in, his verse was surprisingly good. In contrast, T.S. Eliot was regarded learned in all that befitted a poet to know. Time has worked the reversal, however, and as Kathleen Rainey, who I think I read not long ago, had just not very long ago passed away, she was, of course, the great poet in her own right, British, and the greatest authority on Blake. So Kathleen Rainey wrote about Yeats as follows: "There is a tradition of spiritual knowledge which comprises a body of learning not taught in the schools, with its own great literature, besides its unwritten gnosis, accessible only to those who submit themselves, as Yeats did, to a spiritual discipline. Yeats was in his own field a learned, even a scholarly poet, though not in the academic sense. So this is, of course, our focus of interest, and we may ask ourselves, therefore, at this point, in order to clarify this subject, what was this mystical life that he wrote about, that he called the center of all that he does and all that he thinks and all that he writes? And we might answer that, I think, very briefly in the following manner. The mystical or occult core of Yeats's life, he was composed of the following spiritual elements. Number one, the Kabbalistic, magical, alchemical, and Rosicrucian tradition, both in theory and practice, which he received by way of the Order of the Golden Dawn. This was really the single most important element. And I would suggest, and probably fairly correct in suggesting, that the reason that this element comes first in the evaluation of the sources for Yeats is that this was both a practical and a theoretical matrix at once. Because the Golden Dawn stood rather uniquely in its time, and of course a whole tradition emerged from it, even though the order itself, the original order, went underground so quickly, and that the Golden Dawn was intended both as an academy of mystico-magical information, and at the same time also a practical arena, an ongoing practical workshop of magical experience. So theory and practice together. The second source that Yeats had access to, and that he valued highly, and of course all of these are interconnected with each other, as you will no doubt quickly discern, was the universal and all-encompassing occult cosmos containing both Western and Eastern elements, which was and is presented in the works of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, particularly in The Secret Doctrine, the principal literary work of that remarkable woman. And we'll encounter a little more about that, speaking of Yeats, that of course he was personally acquainted with Madame Blavatsky, who indeed liked him very much. Of course, he was just a young man, and this was within her last years in London, and who used to refer to him affectionately as our Willie. The third source was the Eastern mystical doctrines of life, derived particularly from Hindu sources, which reached him by way of three persons. A gentleman by the name of Mohini Mohun Chatterjee, who was a Hindu disciple of Madame Blavatsky, and came with Madame Blavatsky to England, and became a sort of teacher in his own right. Secondly, the great and well-known Bengali poet and mystic Rabindranath Tagore, whom Yeats had some association with, and the Vedantian-oriented Indian scholar of the Upanishads, Purohit Swami. So these were the sources of his interest and of his information. Of course, his, as we will see, and hopefully I will have the opportunity to at least quote a few samplings to you of his poems which show his mystical and occult and magical involvement. Really, that magical involvement runs in one way or the other through all of his work. But we also need to keep in mind that Between 1917 and 1919, Yeats and his wife wrote under, under occult auspices, I think for the most part by way of automatic writing, a considerable book that is called A Vision. I have subjected it to a study at one time, and if you are interested, sometime I'll do one or two or three talks on it. It is highly complicated work. What it really is a kind of cosmological and psychological treatise that indicates a vast developmental pattern for the human soul and for the human character. And also within that contains a certain typology, like psychological or spiritual types of humanity, and how these types change and develop and grow into a greater and greater consciousness and insight. It's a fascinating but pretty difficult work. So that was really the only work that Yeats was involved in, which was strictly speaking occult and not really poetic. But we are getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. Before considering some of these factors, it may be necessary for us to inform ourselves regarding the major events, let's say, in the life of Yeats himself. Yeats had an ironic view also of how people are going to regard him in the future. He wrote in one of his writings, "In after time they will speak much of me and speak but fantasy." So maybe that's what we are doing here, I'm not sure. He was born in 1865 and died in 1939. He came from an interesting line of Anglo-Irishmen, wherein his grandfather, I believe, was a famous portrait painter, a member of the Pre-Raphaelite community, you know, the people to whom belong Dante Gabriele Rossetti and Burns Jones and all of those folk. Very beautiful material. And they had sort of their own community there for a number of years in Bedford Park in London, and Yeats's ancestor belonged to them. Yeats grew up at his mother's home in Sligo in Ireland, and there he grew up in early childhood. At the age of 9 in 1874, his mother brought him to England. In 1880, under financial pressure, they moved back to Ireland, lived a few miles outside of Dublin. He completed his schooling in Dublin, became acquainted with a number of creative and exciting people there who were all, without publicizing it much, involved in the esoteric and particularly the theosophy of Madame Blavatsky. Among them, George Russell, Charles Johnston, and the aforementioned Hindu gentleman Mohini Chatterjee. And later in 1887, he moved to London and there became acquainted personally with Madame Blavatsky, who was living her last years there. It all really began when Yeats was an art student in Dublin, and there had this increasing association with a number of people led by George Russell, who is also known by the initials of A.E. and was a fairly well-known poet at the time. Now, George Russell, or A.E., was a student of theosophy and an acquaintance of an early theosophical leader, A.P. Sinnett. The young men, who were all interested in these things, formed the Dublin Hermetic Society. Mohini Chatterjee came to Dublin and sort of helped them out with a lot of first-hand experience and meditation techniques and knowledge of the Hindu scriptures and things of that sort. So Yeats's orientation to art changed under the influence of the spiritual philosophy, and he gave voice to this where he wrote, and I quote again, "If we poets are to move the people, we must reintegrate the human spirit in our imagination." He came to appreciate also the importance of dreams as an avenue to the inner worlds, and he wrote about that. "All would be well could we but give us wholly to the dreams and get into their world that to the sense is shadow, and not linger wretchedly among substantial things, for it is dreams that lift us to the flowing, changing world that the heart longs for." Well, he's almost repeating there Shakespeare's statement from The Tempest, "We are such stuff as dreams are made of." He translated a lot of Mohini Chatterjee's prose into verse, so there were extensive quotations from the Bhagavad Gita on the Hindu scriptures that Yeats put into poetry, and thus he was led then from Ireland and subsequently from wherever his domicile was in London by Mohini Chatterjee primarily to the mysterious, glorious, miracle-working, leg-pulling, serious and funny woman Magus Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. And he joined Blavatsky's Theosophical Society in 1887. He even joined her esoteric school, which, however, he resigned from by 1890, but he remained a great admirer of Madame Blavatsky. In fact, his person, which, as I indicated before, was very dear to Madame Blavatsky, had a lot to do with the favors, let us say, that Madame Blavatsky extended to the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and to its leaders. Of course, there were a lot of people involved in the Golden Dawn who were also all Madame Blavatsky's students and theosophists, but Yeats was very greatly valued by her. Now, this is a minor technicality that probably most of you are not interested in, but I'll tell you anyway, that, you know, Madame Blavatsky, in addition to having inspired the founding of the Theosophical Society, also had a kind of an inner school of her own, where she was trying to train people in deeper occult things. That was called the Esoteric School, and Yeats was a member of that, right at the time when he was approached by some of the chiefs of the Golden Dawn, where they would join the Golden Dawn. Now, if you belonged to Madame Blavatsky's Esoteric School, you were not supposed to join any other organization. But Madame Blavatsky made an exception for the Golden Dawn. And it is said that she made that exception primarily because she wanted to accommodate Yeats. But of course she also accommodated a lot of other people at the same time. So Yeats was initiated into the Golden Dawn apparently on March 7th, 1889. And he had chosen the magical motto, which everybody did in the Golden Dawn. When you were initiated in the Golden Dawn, you so to say chose a new name. Actually, if you went through all the degrees in the higher order, then two names, one in the lower order, one in the higher order. And from then on, in the ceremonial gatherings and so forth of the Golden Dawn, you were referred to as Frater or Soror, meaning brother or sister, such and such. You need to keep in mind that the founding chiefs of the Golden Dawn were all Freemasons. prominent Freemasons at that. And so some of the customs of that sort in the Golden Dawn had vaguely Masonic resemblance. So in any event, what people chose was not so much what we would call a name, but a short sentence that exemplified sort of their principal spiritual orientation or their intentions, you know. And Yeats chose the motto for himself in the Golden Dawn, the sentence, Demon est Deus inversus, meaning the demon is the inverted God. So he was quite friendly with some of the founders of the Golden Dawn, particularly with the redoubtable Samuel Liddell MacGregor Mathers, the weird Scotsman, the weird magical Scotsman who had so much to do with the organizing and leading the Golden Dawn. And they were quite good friends for a while. And then later on, they had a falling out, which was very easy to do with Mathers, maybe also fairly easy to do with Yeats, because, these were very intense and very cantankerous people. They got their nose out of joint very easily, which actually is I have found it such as a problem with magicians. You know, magicians are hard to please and they easily get offended. In any event, Yeats still maintained sort of at a distance fairly good feeling about Mathers, and Mathers preceded Yeats in death by many years. Died, I think, in Paris, where he lived for a long time. Now, Yeats wrote, all of his poems are beautiful, but he wrote a wonderful poem. It's a little bit long. I may recite it, or at least read it at our Halloween party, because it is called All Souls Night. And it describes I don't know whether it's poetic fiction, but with Yeats's proclivities, I'm pretty sure that it was perhaps quite true, that on All Souls Night in his place in London, he sits down and he invokes various spirits of people whom he knew. I'll just read you the first verse and then I'll read you the part about MacGregor Mathers. Midnight has come and the great Christ Church bell, and many a lesser bell sounds through the room, and it is All Souls' Night. And two long glasses brimmed with muscatel bubble upon the table. A ghost may come, for it is a ghost's right. His element is so fine, being sharpened by his death to drink from the wine breath, while our gross palates drink from the whole wine. So what he did was he put down this sweet wine on the table, expecting the ghosts when they come to inhale the fumes. You know, it's not an uncommon thing. It's kind of strange. I don't want to get too personal, but some of you will recognize whom I'm speaking of. But I had a friend for quite some years who had a beautiful little daughter. When she got to be about 18 years old, she was murdered. Very tragic situation. I helped to bury her and so forth. Maybe a month or 6 weeks after her death, I had a dream. And there she was. Sarah was her name. And Sarah said to me in the dream, if you take some wine and pour it down on the ground and recite the Aretology of Isis, which is an ancient Alexandrian poem to Isis, you know, then I will come to you. Well, I was so excited by that communication that I delayed and delayed before I did the deed, which probably I shouldn't have done. Then I did, but she didn't appear visibly, But let's say there was a change of consciousness. I think that perhaps she was there. I kept her picture in that place in my room for many, many years. So, you know, these are the it's an old magical custom, actually, to have some kind of an offering for the ghost or the spirit of the dead. And that the spirits would somehow be able to take in an etheric or a higher aspect of whatever it was. You have that in folk magic for many places, for instance, Mexico in the Day of the Dead and so on. Many other countries too, where people put food out on the graves and so for the dead. Now they know that the dead are not going to come and eat the food, no matter how much they like the tacos or whatever the case may be. But they feel that they're attracted to it, they partake of some aspect of it. So in any way, this is what he does, and then he invokes several people. And then he comes to the spirit of MacGregor Mathers. I call MacGregor Mathers from his grave, for in my first hard springtime we were friends, although of late estranged. I thought him half a lunatic, half knave, and told him so, but friendship never ends, and what if mind seemed changed, and it seemed changed with the mind, when thoughts rise up unbid on generous things that he did, and I grow half contented to be blind. This is how he sort of makes up with MacGregor Mathers. He had much industry at setting out, much boisterous courage before loneliness had driven him crazed, for meditations upon unknown thought make human intercourse grow less and less. They are neither paid nor praised, but he'd object to the host, the glass because my glass, a ghost lover he was, and may have grown more arrogant being a ghost. This was his part about Mathers. Now, the Golden Dawn taught him much good, no doubt about it. Magic that today we would perceive as having psychological implications. So let's say, you know, if you are not terribly inclined to look upon magic as magic or be skeptical about it, you might be able to convince yourself that magic may be a mythologized and ritualized aspect of psychology, and that psychological growth and transformation and insight may be indeed facilitated by such things. Because after all, what do you think people did throughout the many, many centuries and indeed millennia before there was any Sigmund Freud and any Carl Jung and people like that, when they wanted to, get in touch with their higher self, have experiences of psychological growth, development, expansion, and so forth? Well, one of the things that they did was magic. Another thing that they did was alchemy. All of these things have certainly that kind of an aspect. You can see sort of some of the elements that could be interpreted, particularly in Jungian psychological terms, such as here is in one of his essays, which would have to do with evoking the shadow part of his own personality. By the help of an image, I call to my own opposite, summon all that I have handled least looked upon. Now, if you have any little knowledge of Jungian psychology, then you will see that this is about as clear a statement of what a shadow is supposed to be as you can get. He also wrote a poem about destiny. It's in his collected poems, which indicates his Golden Dawn symbolism. It's full of Golden Dawn symbolism. And here, well, anyway, you'll see what it leads up to. until the axle break that keeps the stars in their rounds, and hands hurl in the deep the banners of east and west, and the girdle of light is unbound, your breast will not lie by the breast of your beloved in sleep. Not a very nice thing to say, but it indicates for a very, very long time. And of course, things like the banners of the east and the west are part of the, very important part of the furnishings of a Golden Dawn Lodge. You know, one is white, the other one is black, certain designs on them. In 1924, the year that he received the Nobel Prize of Literature, William Butler Yeats spoke and wrote to a group of young people in London who were about to start a review of literature. And he wrote for that, you know, a magazine, a literary magazine. And this is what he wrote. We proclaim that we can forgive the sinner, but abhor the atheist. Well, I guess he wouldn't be so much in favor of some of these fellows now. We abhor the atheist. We condemn the art and literature of modern Europe. No man can create as did Shakespeare, Homer, Sophocles, who does not believe with all his blood and nerve that man's soul is immortal, for the evidence lies plain to all men that where that belief has declined, men have turned from creation to photography. Now what he means, of course, is that instead of an artistic creation, a mere factual reproduction of external reality, you know, we call back the soul to its ancient sovereignty. In his mystical book, Vision, he wrote as follows, my instructors, these are mystical instructors within, you know, spiritual guides, my instructors identify consciousness with conflict, not with knowledge. Substitute for subject and object and their attendant logic a struggle towards harmony, towards unity of being. Here again, there is, I think, a great convergence with, say, Jungian psychology and so forth, that we come to a condition as the result of our development, if we are lucky and if things go well, where there is a coming together, a unification of the human being, that the objective to be sought is oneness, an indestructible unity, as Jung called it, and not anything else, not just knowing a lot, you know, not just being a real goody-goody, but a union, and this union starts out with conflict, where the opposing forces in the soul, in the psyche, try to interact with each other and then ultimately unify. Thus the alchemical paradigm is very present there. So there is absolute proof, shall we say, that Yeats continued to practice the magical path right into his old age, right into death. Now you need to remember that the way the curriculum of the Golden Dawn was set up was that you went to the what they call temples rather than lodges. That's where the initiations, the conferring of grades and various things like that went on. But you were taught there how to do magical rituals, if necessary, by yourself. When you got to a certain grade, which was the fifth grade, Adeptus Minor, that entitled you to set up your own temple, wherever you wanted to, in your house, and perform various ceremonial magical rituals there. I had the good fortune quite a number of years ago, for instance, to see the temple equipment of the late Dr. Israel Regardi, who became a friend, really wonderful gentleman. And so he had the great requirement. He was an Adeptus Minor. And so he had all. He had the pillars, he had the banners, he had the wand, the sword, the pentacle, the altar, you know, all kinds of things. And he would practice the Golden Dawn rituals by himself, you know. He did lend us some of his equipment on a couple of occasions. Very, 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 very fine man. But he even made his own, which Golden Dawn members were supposed to do, whether they were artistic or not, they had to make their own tarot deck, which was done according to, they were given instructions what should be on the deck, but they had to make it themselves. And Dr. Regardi did have one. And so Yeats obviously had his own temple, and I don't know at how great an intervals he would, you know, practice various magical evocations, invocations, various rituals there, and he felt that these were of great importance and great value to his creativity. Now, when we are talking about a poet, I think that probably the best way to really gain an impression of the poet is by way of his poetry. So I already read a few pieces here and there, but I'll do a few more before we go on to The Unfortune, a very different kind of a creative writer, but still a great magician and a great writer himself. What is probably best known and always quoted of Yeats is really a portion, I think there's another verse, of a poem that is called The Second Coming. And you undoubtedly, most of you have heard it or read it before. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. And then comes the, so to say, the prophecy. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming, hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs while all about it real shadows of the indignant desert burns. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle, and what rough beast its hour come round at last slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. Again, a very awesome kind of thing. You read this to a good Christian, you say, gee whiz, I mean, it sounds more like the coming of a demon. Huh? In any event, that was his vision, and there he was. Here is a beautiful passage from another poem of his, Sailing to Byzantium, which is really, I regard this as his paean of praise to what Madame Blavatsky would have called the masters. This is addressed to the great spiritual beings who, according to theosophy and some of these teachings, are sort of, you know, in the background of the world's happening. O sages standing in God's holy fire, as in the gold mosaic of a wall, come from the holy fire, burn in gyre, and be the singing masters of my soul. Consume my heart away, sick with desire, and fastened to a dying animal. It knows not what it is, and gather me into the artifice of eternity. I remember that very often. Here it is, you know, where fastened to a dying animal. That's what we are. And the dying animal is the body. Because even when it's very healthy and kicking up like a frisky horse, you know, its days are numbered. And the most Gnostic of his prayers that I have collected is a little, again, a little stanza which he wrote for a particular initiation of the Golden Dawn, the 7 = 4. It is an initiation that allows you to leave the earth, so to say. And he writes, "We are weighed down by the blood and the heavy weight of the bones. We are bound by flowers, and our feet are entangled in the green, and there is deceit in the singing of birds. It is time to be done with it all. The stars call, and all the planets, and the purging fire of the moon, and yonder is the cold silence of cleansing night. May the dawn break and gates of day be set wide open." I think that with some of those, we can, in due course, say goodbye to Willie Yeats, and no doubt with the conviction that here was a man who of tremendous talent and greatly recognized major literary figure of the world, who at the same time was thoroughly devoted to the esoteric, the magical path, and who indeed received his inspiration, his creativity from those sources. Now we turn our attention to another person who was also a member of the Golden Dawn, and who received a tremendous amount of inspiration from that, and who also became a rather well-known writer, but of a different kind. While Yeats was, you know, in there with the greatest of poets, Dion Fortune became primarily known as an occult novelist, not a great writer as writers go, but able to communicate, let's say, mystico-magical realities by way of novels that are very exciting and very romantic, and we'll come to some of the titles in a minute, and in each one there is some particular teaching, usually of the Golden Dawn, that is exemplified in the novel. So she was really one of the most remarkable figures of the female gender associated with wizardry in modern times. Her secular name was Violet Mary Firth, known now under the magical nom de plume as Dion Fortune. I'll tell you in a minute why. She was born in the last decade of the 19th century in 1891. Like so many of her kith and kin, she spent a magical childhood wherein her imagination developed early and played a prominent role. Her parents were Christian Scientists, which meant that they were daring religious nonconformists in their time. It's, you know, that's how things change. I mean, nowadays if you go to Christian Science Church, there will be very nice people there, but there will be very, well, how should we put it, sort of rather prosaic appearance and time. Certainly no countercultural or highly imaginative folk. But there was a time when all over the world, and here and in Europe, to be a Christian Scientist meant that you were really way out there on the cutting edge of the religious and spiritual world, you know. Nevertheless, her Christian Scientist parents did worry a good deal about little Violet, mainly because they felt that she was far too addicted to what they call daydreaming. So there is once again your element of imagination. So she had a lot of involvement early in her life with fantasy, imagination, dream, and daydream. And of course we need to keep in mind that that kind of magical childhood, shall we say, was a common trait of many of the more creative and more magical individuals in modern times, certainly H.P. Blavatsky, Rudolf Steiner, Dion Fortune herself, C.G. Jung, are just a few prominent examples. All of these people learned to make use of reverie placed within a variety of meaningful contexts in the kind of occult or psychological disciplines that they were to teach and practice. And I'll just mention one of the psychological variety, and that is that fairly early in his career, C.G. Jung, for instance, came upon a psychological technique which is generally called the active imagination, although in the earlier time, back at its inception, it was often called visioning. And what it really means is it's a kind of a purposeful daydreaming. You close your eyes, you kind of quiet yourself in a sort of meditative manner, and you allow some imagery, usually with some kind of a story, to develop before your eyes. One way that it can be done is if you had a dream and you want to continue with that dream, or you want to see how that dream might continue, then you remember a particular image, a particular incident in the dream, possibly the one that was the last image that you saw, and you close your eyes and you will yourself back into that image and then see what develops. And Jung has found that this kind of reverie, purposeful daydreaming, can be very revelatory in terms of the inner archetypal psychology of the individual. Others have used it to other advantage. And it is often forgotten by those who approach such matters, especially if they approach them with an overly concrete orientation, that a great deal of what is called seership, clairvoyance, and things of that description are based upon the imagination. For instance, there was a noted theosophical clairvoyant years ago, C.W. Leadbeater, who wrote a lot about his impressions of what he saw and so forth, really very interesting, very valuable material. And I was in Australia, in fact, in the house where he used to live, great many years after he died. But there were still some people around who knew him, who were very young at that time when he was there. He died about 36, something like that. And I conversed with them, and they asked them, what did C.W. Leadbeater would tell you about how to approach clairvoyance? And he said, he inevitably said, use and trust your imagination. That's the beginning. If you don't have that, then you're never going to get anywhere. So that is of interest in this case also. Curiously enough, the determining event which was to set the direction of Dion Fortune's life was an incident of a very negative nature which injured her badly and which impelled her to devote herself to the investigation of the deep dimensions and mysteries of the mind. When she was about 20 years old, that is a few years before the outbreak of World War I, she suffered a curious traumatic experience. She took a job at a small private educational establishment, a sort of girls' academy. The principal of the school, a domineering and unpleasant woman, who was a good deal older than young Violet, made serious efforts to dominate the younger woman in all sorts of ways. And when her schemes did not quite work out, she became very incensed. To make the long story short, it was Violet's belief that the school principal took revenge on her by hexing her or cursing her in some occult manner, and this took a terrible toll on Violet, who remained shattered in mind and in body. Now, it's not my purpose to go into speculations about what may have happened and how these things are done, but let's say, in my opinion, at least in my experience, there has to be a certain vulnerability, there has to be a certain susceptibility to that kind of thing. But if you have a vulnerable psyche and a very unpleasant, nasty person who knows how to do this sort of thing, to curse somebody or to hex somebody, then some very, very unhappy things definitely can ensue. I've seen it happen. So undoubtedly something of this sort was taking place here. So it appears that it took her years to recover from this experience, and there were those who claimed that she maybe never truly recovered from it at all, although she would have disputed that. Decades later, in a book called Psychic Self-Defense, and I think most of the Unfortunes books are still available, she wrote as follows: "It was this experience which led me to take up the study of analytical psychology and subsequently of occultism." So thus Violet Firth first turned to psychoanalysis, which was a very new and fashionable discipline at that time, and in due course received training as a Freudian psychoanalyst. This was all in England. She was never a medical doctor, and so she never became what we would call a licensed analyst, but she was what people refer to a lay analyst. She retained a lifelong interest in depth psychology and wrote some books on strictly psychological subjects under her own secular name, Violet Firth. Her strong awareness of the sexual component of the psyche, and consequently of magic and occultism, was no doubt in part due to her Freudian training. After Jungian psychology established itself in England and as a separate school, her sympathies were much more Jungian, but soon they shifted to an area beyond psychology proper, namely to magic and the Kabbalah. She wrote of this, and I quote, "As soon as I watched the direction of a mind under psychoanalysis, I realized that there was much more in the mind than was accounted for by the accepted psychological theories." She turned to occultism, but not like many others to just occult theory, but rather to practice as well. Thus, at an early age, probably while she was still in her 20s, she was initiated into the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, her initiation bringing to her her first real healing from the psychic trauma, which is rather interesting. Dion Fortune's acquaintance with the original Order of the Golden Dawn was powerful, albeit rather brief. She claimed that initiation into the grades of the Order repaired the damage wrought by the occult assault she suffered at the age of 20. She accounted for this by the theory that initiation sealed her damaged etheric body, which since the time of the attack was leaking energy like a broken vessel. Since etheric bodies, whether leaking or not leaking, are not of the order of empirical reality, we may or may not accept this explanation. Be this as it may, Violet Firth was in much better psychological and physical condition since her entry into the Golden Dawn. She found, it would seem, a matrix that was at once practical and theoretical. The Golden Dawn system, based as it is on the great mystical glyph of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, gave her a workable scheme which she could use to catalog and understand her own unusual experiences in both this world and the next. She emerged from her Golden Dawn initiations as a full-fledged magical adept, qualified to teach and practice the Golden Dawn methods and the art magic in general. By a curious synchronicity, it was at this very time in the 1920s that the Golden Dawn closed down its temples and for all intents and purposes ceased as a functioning organization. Its leading members went their own way, some like William Butler Yeats retiring into private life and practicing magic by themselves, while others, such as A.E. Wade, Aleister Crowley, and in America Paul Foster Case, founded their own magical orders more or less based on the theories and practices of the Golden Dawn. In the latter category, we may include Violet Firth, who soon after the closing of the Golden Dawn organized her own magical group. It was called, and I believe it's still in existence, the Fraternity of the Inner Light. This organization was of at least two divisions, the outer being a correspondence school in Kabbalah and in magical theory. The second and inner being a working order with regularly conducted temple rituals led by the foundress, requiring residency in England on the part of its members. By this time, Violet Firth became increasingly known as Dionne Fortune, a name she designed from the wording of her magical motto, just like the one that Yeats had, in the Golden Dawn, which in Latin read Deo non fortune, to God, not to fortune. And she chose to indicate, I think, by that motto, that she owed her rebirth to God and not to mere blind fortune. Now, Dionne Fortune attained her greatest fame as an author. Her psychological treatises written under her own name of Violet Firth were of no particular consequence. But her occult and cabalistic works, and even more her delightful occult novels, attracted a fairly wide and devoted membership. Among the former, her work Psychic Self-Defense, which I mentioned already, published in 1930, was clearly motivated by her personal misfortune of having been injured in her psyche. She developed methods and techniques whereby to diagnose and counteract psychic attacks and wished to make these available to others. Her chief work, at least in my opinion, is undoubtedly the book entitled The Mystical Kabbalah, published in 1935, which remained to this day one of the most lucid, readable books on the Tree of Life. It is a work that is elementary as well as profound and occupies a unique position in Kabbalistic literature. This book also shows a decided influence of Aleister Crowley, whose pioneering work on magical correspondences and symbolic affinities had a deep influence on Dionne Fortune. Now, I need to mention something there. I have really nothing against Crowley as such. I don't think that he was the devil. But the way this really happened was that Crowley was a great copier, a great plagiarizer. You know, he would take something from somebody else's book or anywhere else and write it down, never give him credit. And of course, that's rather easy to do because, you know, how can you, Kabbalistic things and things of that sort, how can you prove anything one way or the other? But what Crowley had done, he had taken, which were unpublished, I think, at the time, he had taken unpublished manuscripts of MacGregor Mathers, the founder of the one of the founding chiefs of the Golden Dawn, and he published them himself in a book that is called Liber 777. Those are not Crowley's original correspondences, they were taken from Mathers. But most people, of course, had access to Crowley's work rather than the original. And so did Dionne Fortune. So Dionne Fortune undoubtedly admired Crowley to a considerable degree, but she was also deathly afraid of being associated with him in the eyes of the public, which looked upon Crowley as a mad and malign monster. Her ambivalence towards some of Crowley's emphasis in matters of sex and the occult is evident in her books. For instance, Dion Fortune wrote a book called The Esoteric Philosophy of Love and Marriage, which is very liberal and very permissive in tone, and which hints at her sympathetic acquaintance with sexual magic. On the other hand, she wrote another book called The Problem of Purity, which is filled with puritanical clichés of the most obnoxious kind, so that one comes to the conclusion that she wished to play the two books against each other. Her early work, Sane Occultism, went a long way exposing, well, let's say, the then rather customary stupidity in many occult circles. Some of her other non-fiction works are The Avalon of the Heart, The Esoteric Orders and Their Work, The Training and Work of an Initiate, and Practical Occultism in Daily Life. Like some other writers influenced by Blavatsky and her theosophy, Dion Fortune also wrote her own kind of secret doctrine, dealing with occult cosmogony and psychology, and entitled The Cosmic Doctrine. Like Blavatsky's much larger work, it is abstract and obscure in the extreme. So I wouldn't recommend that you start with that one if you start reading Dion Fortune. Her novels, on the other hand, really were her greatest medium of communication and popularity. Some of these are The Demon Lover, a fascinating thriller involving psychic vampirism and exorcism of vampirical agencies. In it are embodied, in a slightly veiled fashion, some of the magical formulae of the Golden Dawn, how to exorcise an entity that besets somebody. So they're right in there. The Winged Bull, another one of her novels, deals with a revival of Assyrian archetypes and contains disguised allusions to sexual magic. The Goatfoot God, which was always my favorite, which is perhaps really one of her most delightful, evokes scenes of medieval Europe and of the evocation of the goat-footed Pan, as well as an invocation of the sun god Helios. Very, very interesting, very, very exciting book. The two novels of Dion Fortune which have elicited the most comments in recent years are The Sea Priestess, published in 1938, and the posthumously published Moon Magic, that wasn't published in 1957. Both have much to do with the theme of woman as the magical priestess, and thus arouse the interest of contemporary feminist circles. It needs to be mentioned, however, that in these books, as indeed in other literature that she authored, the feminine is always represented at its best and most powerful when mated with the masculine. Moon and sun, woman and man, the alchemical queen and king, are envisioned as the magical couple who together bring back the mysteries to the world and divine power and joy to themselves. Since she uses the name Morgana Le Fay in both of these books, albeit in a benign manner, it is quite likely that the more recently, within the last 20 years in any event, appeared popular book by Marion Zimmer Bradley, The Mists of Avalon, was inspired by these two books by Dion Fortune. In the wake of the interest evinced in Dion Fortune by feminist and pagan circles, opinions have been heard to the effect that she was a witch, a secret prophetess of Wicca, and thus a feminist pagan. There is only a modest amount of truth in these opinions. She assuredly was a proto-feminist in the sense that she had recognized the great magical potential of the feminine psyche in her own life, and that she felt that it needed emphasis and understanding. but she was no separatist or female chauvinist, as some have become today. Dion Fortune knew that the interaction of male and female produced true magic, the true alchemy, and that the feminine and masculine, when bereft of each other, are, as she, using her words, magical cripples. Neither was Dion Fortune ever a pagan, if this means that she did not value and reverently practice the Christian tradition in the esoteric sense. Early in her career, she organized a Theosophical Lodge, that is a branch of the Theosophical Society, called Esoteric Christian Lodge in England, and wrote a book in which she esoterically interpreted the collects of the Book of Common Prayer of the Church of England. Very beautiful book. She also wrote a Rite of Holy Communion of the Guild of the Master Jesus, which is a fine and quite traditional mass in the Christian sense. It is not impossible that she was a secretly ordained priest herself, having been secretly raised to that office by a friendly bishop, probably of the liberal Catholic Church in England. In any event, she performed the rite of the Mass not infrequently and with great devotion. It is a pity that she was not much younger. I always felt she would have made a great Gnostic priest or priestess today. Wouldn't it be nice to have Dion Fortune here to say Mass? But of course, by now she would be more than 100 years old, so wouldn't work all that well. In 1946, Dion Fortune felt unwell. In December of 1945, she visited a Jungian psychiatrist in London, my late friend, Dr. Lawrence Bendit. And Dr. Bendit told me the story of how that went. A lady came to his consulting room who didn't give her name. And I was all right with him. He asked her, what, as doctors always do, what's the matter? You know, all doctors are materialists because they ask you what's the matter, right? And so she said, I don't know, but I feel strange. I feel as if something of a major nature is about to happen, and I don't quite know what it is. Maybe it's some kind of initiation or something or the other. And since she knew, I think, that Dr. Bendit was both a Jungian analyst and a theosophist, he would have had, sympathy for this sort of thing. So they talked, and then they set up an appointment for after Christmas, when she would come back to see him again. And the time came, and Dr. Bendit looked in the paper, in the newspaper, and there was the picture of the lady who had come to him and said, Dion Fortune, a famous writer, just died. So then he found out who it was. He didn't know her before. So around Christmas, she traveled to one of her favorite haunts, Glastonbury. She returned with what appeared to be a dental infection. She became ever more ill and was admitted to Middlesex Hospital in London, where she died of acute leukemia. She was 55 years old. Her body was buried in Glastonbury as she desired. Her Society of the Inner Light struggled on under other leadership, rather inferior leadership, and still has some sort of shadowy existence. But there was no way to replace Dion Fortune. She could have no true successor. The line was broken. As she wrote in her poem, The Rite of Isis, and I'll mention something about that in a minute, "For behold, we arise with the dawn of time from the gray and misty sea, and with the dusk we sink in the western ocean. And the lives of men are strung like pearls on the thread of the spirit, and never in all his journeys goes he alone, for that which is solitary is barren." This is very Egyptian in tone. It has the Egyptian mythos, you know, of the boat of Ra rising in the morning and then sinking down in the evening, and that's the one on which the gods ride. Now, there's a interesting element that I think I can add to this, and that has to do with an idea that she voiced, particularly in the two books, Moon Magic and Sea Priestess, which I mentioned to you before. And I think Moon Magic wasn't published till after her death. And that goes like this. It's the idea of the Black Isis. And what she said was that there is a primordial elemental essence of a spiritually feminine characteristics that is derived, and mark this now, not from earth or unregenerate nature, but from a region beyond the moon and the stars. This power, she said, must be liberated and mated to its complement in the male. A power needs to be released which is feminine in nature, but which is obscured and misunderstood but still present. So a magically devised and controlled interplay of the opposites or of sexual polarity is needed. Now, time is about up, but I was very taken by that image, and believe you me, I am not a feminist. Neither feminine nor feminist. It's not my thing. I have lived in Hollywood for many years, but, you know, I don't go like this. Let's put it that way, okay? But there is a very important and very mysterious thing that she was trying to convey, and which in my wanderings in the aeons I have also encountered. And it has to do with a feminine presence that is celestial rather than earthly, and which indeed it was originally the Black Isis, then also came to manifest apparently as the Gnostic Sophia, and which, let us say, is a spiritual, magical force in the world. You know, you have to remember that symbolism is not universally fixed. So, you know, people go around, Mother Earth, and the Earth is feminine and all of that. You know what? To the Egyptians, the Earth was masculine. It was old Geb, from which comes geology and things like that. And he was about as masculine as you can get. And you, the mountains and trees and any things that sort of stand out from the world, from the earth, they were regarded as the male member of Father Earth, you know, or Jeb. And the sky, however, was feminine. Okay? So you can see that here with the Black Isis who comes from beyond this world. And so what we have here, I think, is a very interesting and unfortunately very little explored element of the wisdom woman. Now, I'll just throw out little hints that I cannot and will not follow through with. The Black Madonnas, for instance. There is a good deal of evidence indicating that the Black Madonna's image originally, I mean, I don't want to take away from the Christian Madonna, because that would be wrong too, but that archetype sort of originated with Isis. And that the first Black Madonnas which appeared in Spain and the south of France and so forth were originally imported from Egypt. Mm-hmm. So that is one manifestation of it. The Gnostic Sophia is another. And there are yet others. Robert Graves, the great poet and mythologist toward the end of his life, had come to also recognize what he called the black goddess. He wrote a big book on the white goddess, you know. Then he told, at the end of his life, he wrote some shorter essays on the black goddess. And he felt that that is black because it's still in the dark. It's about to emerge into the light. So Dion Fortune caught on to something here, and that at a rather early time. And it is, I think, worth observing. But of course, if there is something to be done with this archetype, then I think the stereotypical association, which comes from Wicca and things like that, of the feminine being earth, has to be abandoned. And a little larger and a little different view needs to be taken. So I think, you know, Dion Fortune was a prophet. And a very interesting and very important spiritual influence. If you read her novels and so, it shines through that there is a sort of wise and kindly and at the same time sprightly and very romantic soul behind these books, you know. She can describe anything. An old street in London filled with old bookstores, and you close your eyes and you're there, you know. It just, her powers of description and the sort of the romantic ambience that she creates are truly sublime. And all of that, of course, was stimulated and helped by what she learned in the Golden Dawn and also in the Theosophical Society. And so these are the two, you know, very important literary figures who came out of the Golden Dawn and whose work in many, many ways is still with us. So I hope that our little journey and our visits to William Butler Yeats and to Dion Fortune have been of some interest to you, and with that I'll bid you a good night.
Copyright MMD-III by BC Recordings, catalog number 3014-04. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org, that's gnosis.org.